started. Welcome, everybody, to the last official session of today before it's party time. I'm glad y'all are all here to learn a little bit more about the Better Together features in Exchange 2013 when you combine it with Link 2013. So for those of you that I haven't seen before and haven't met, there are a lot of Link people I haven't met yet because I'm still relatively new to the Link world. My name is Paul Robichaud. I'm part of Dell's Global Infrastructure Consulting Services practice, where I do some work on Link, mostly work with Exchange and Office 365. So from that perspective, I want to start by asking how many of you consider yourselves to be Exchange administrators or knowledgeable about Exchange? Okay, good. That's more than in the first time I did this session. How many of you are fairly new to Link as well? Anybody? Okay, a couple of people. Good. Do I have any Lotus Notes administrators in here? X. All right, great. In that case, y'all are my honored guests. I'm glad you're up in the front row. I'm glad you've seen the light. Welcome to the promised land. Yeah, IBM just, they re-released, I can't remember what they call it now. They have a new mail social product, but I can't remember the name. It's not Connections. It's something else like IBM Social Plus Pro Gold or something. The fact that I can't remember its name probably tells you everything you need to know about it. Okay, so enough mocking Exchange's former competitors. Let's get on to the good stuff. So quick introduction, then I'm going to spend some time talking about OAuth, which is not only hard to pronounce, but it's a little hard to understand because we already have a perfectly good server-to-server authentication mechanism called Kerberos. One of the very common questions I get when I'm talking about this material with people is, well, why didn't we just use Kerberos? It turns out there's a good reason for it that I'm going to discuss a bit later. Then I'm going to step through the new features that you get when you deploy Exchange 2013 alongside Link 2013. Once we've got the table set and you understand what those features are, then we can move on to talking about how you integrate Exchange and Link to actually make those features work, right? The good news is that from the Exchange perspective, there's very little you have to do to enable these features because most of them are capabilities that are built into Exchange that Link can take advantage of. So the configuration and the management and monitoring and troubleshooting mostly happen on the Link side. Then I'm going to spend a little tiny bit of time talking about hybrid operations. I'm going to forewarn you right now, if hybrid is really your thing, right now in this same time slot is when the Link hybrid deep dive session is scheduled. I don't know if there's a repeat of it tomorrow. So if you're really super interested in hybrid, you probably ought to go to that session instead. Feel free to fill out my evaluation anyway because, you know, Microsoft is really keen on getting lots of evals to use as feedback. So when you think about Exchange and Link and SharePoint, one of the things that comes to mind is that these three products each have their own sort of release trajectory. And you can think of it like a sine wave, right? So the product is in development, we get a new release, and then things sort of float along, the product goes back into development, eventually we get a new release. So if you think of drawing a curve on a piece of paper, the peaks of the curve represent times when Microsoft drops a new release on us and says, hey, this is the new goodness, this is what you should be running. For a long while, though, the Exchange and Link and SharePoint and Desktop Office curves were all out of sync. So Microsoft would do things like ship a release of Exchange and then not ship the version of Outlook that was designed to work with it until 90 days, 120 days, 180 days later, right? Or they would ship a new version of Office, and they would ship a new version of Exchange, and then 6 months later, they would ship a new version of Office Communications Server. So this got really frustrating for customers because one of the truisms of enterprise software is that you can't upgrade everything all the time, right? There was a lot of customer pushback on Microsoft asking them to, if not synchronize their release schedules, at least bring the peaks closer together so that when you were thinking about doing a platform upgrade of your universal communications platform, you could schedule it so that you could upgrade Exchange and Link around the same time that you were deploying a new version of Office to the desktop instead of having to string those things out over a long period. So that's what we got with the 2013 products. We got Exchange 2013, Link 2013, SharePoint 2013, Visio and Project Server 2013 and Office 2013 on the desktop, all more or less at the same time, which means that if you want to upgrade your entire stack, you have the ability to do that without having to wait. Now, why would you want that ability? Well, that's where Microsoft's feature crews come in, right? Their goal was to make the combination of these products so compelling that instead of just deploying Exchange and waiting to update Link or deploying Link and not updating Office on the desktop, They're trying to deliver something that is so shiny and has so much goodness in it that you will want to upgrade all those things at once. So what we're going to be talking about for the next 45 minutes or so are, what are those features and are they really compelling enough to get you to bite the bullet and upgrade right now? So how many of you are on Exchange 2010 still? Okay, who's on Link 2010? Great. How many of you are all 2013 already? Okay, that's good. That's more than I would have expected to see, but given that this is Link conference and not Tech Ed or a SharePoint conference, I get the sense that SharePoint adoption is maybe, SharePoint 2013 adoption is maybe dragging Link and Exchange a little bit. But there are enough customers who look at Link 2013, look at Exchange 2010, or sorry, Link 2010, Exchange 2010, and say, hey, this is great, but we need more resilience. We need some of the other features that the new releases provide. We're going to go ahead and move to it. We've had integration between Exchange and Link for a while, right? In fact, those of you who are graybeards may remember that Exchange used to ship its own instant messaging server back in the Exchange 2000 timeframe, right? For those of you who remember that, it'll probably make you feel kind of old because that even predates LCS, right? So a long time ago, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I still had all my hair, Exchange included IM as part of its core product offering. And then as time went by, first LCS, then OCS, now Link, peeled those features off and added this super long list of additional modalities that Exchange IM never included. If you look at the way these two products tie together, okay, the big one that most people immediately think of as an integration point is the tie-in between Exchange UM and Link. Link is a phone system. Exchange answers the phone like chocolate and peanut butter. They go together. But there's more to it than that. For example, the number one feature I have to be real careful. I was going to say I would bet money. That's not a smart thing to say in Las Vegas. It would greatly surprise me if it were not true that the number one client integration feature in Link is not the fact that people's presence icons show up in Outlook. If you want to see whether somebody's available, you can see it at the minute you type their name into a message composition field. When you're looking at the list of addressees or recipients on a message, you can right-click somebody and start a video call, start an IM, have a meet now with them. Those are all enabled by integration between the Outlook client and the Link client. But there are a bunch of other integration features like that that we have had for a while. I mean, that's an Office XP feature that is carried forward from Office 10 now into Office 15. There are a couple others up here, Skill Search and SharePoint, being able for the Link client having the ability to use EWS to look up things out of Exchange instead of having to use MAPI, which means that now we're free to run the Link client outside the firewall and still get free busy, still get contact pictures, get the other things that EWS access gives us. But there's still been a few additional things missing in the sense that many of these are actually client integration features. The client on one side does something to integrate with the server on the other, and I include Outlook Web App in that because although it is a feature that runs on the server, as far as a user is concerned, when she's looking at her mailbox in OWA, OWA is the client. And the fact that IM and presence can be exposed in that client is a client integration feature. Plus, some of these features were a little tricky or finicky to get integrated and keep them that way. So in Wave 15, in the 2013 wave of products, Microsoft really put a lot of investment into making sure that there were compelling server-side integration features that would either deliver capability that we wouldn't have otherwise, or that would make things better or cheaper or more robust in some way. So there are a couple that we're going to talk about in this context. There are a few others that are specific to SharePoint, and because I'm not a SharePoint guy, I'm not planning on spending any real time talking about them. First one is a unified contact store. Okay? It is what its name implies. It's a single, unitary place to keep all of your Link and Exchange contacts. Well, guess what? You already have a place like that for your Exchange contacts. It's called your contacts folder. So the unified contact store gives Link a way to store its contacts and metadata in the same place that all of your other contacts live already, instead of in a pool-specific SQL database. Okay, when we talk more about the feature, you'll see why that makes sense and what kind of scenarios it unlocks. Having Exchange used as a mechanism for Link archiving gives us some capabilities that otherwise we wouldn't have if we were dependent on the native Link archiving features. high-resolution contact photos. I mean, even my cell phone, which is, you know, a two-year-old phone, and it's, which means it's probably a four-year-old design, can take photos that are far in excess of Microsoft's collaboration stack's ability to display them. But when you think about all the effort that's been invested, I mean, how many of you sing link room systems, right? So you're going to spend a bunch of money to put this gorgeous link room system in your conference room, and then you're going to see speaker photos that look like somebody drew them with a crayon. All right, how much sense does that make? So Microsoft has caught on that one area where they can, you know, improve the subjective quality of the experience is to give people better looking pictures. It's not hard to understand. Some of these technologies are, or some of these features are enabled by new technologies or new components somewhere in the stack. And you'll see what I mean a little later. I've got a diagram that shows the end-to-end stack for 2010 integration and for 2013 integration. You'll see that in the 2013 picture, there are a lot more little boxes because there are more components that tie these services together. Okay, I put this last bullet up here for the first time that I presented this because I often get questions about integrating Exchange UM with Link Enterprise Voice, and that really is a session unto itself. Unfortunately, I did that session about 3 hours ago, so if you missed it, you'll need to watch the recording. Along with the slides from this presentation, that should be another day, day and a half. So by the time y'all get home this weekend, it should be up. Now let's talk OAuth. I really wish it had a more pronounceable name because I tend to stumble over it every time I say it. But maybe we should just go back to calling it Hailstorm. Anybody remember that? Hailstorm and the .NET Passport? When I see Passport, I see a few people get that look on their face like, yeah, I remember that. That was back when Bill Gates was still the chief technical guy. So the idea behind Passport or Hailstorm was very simple. You have a service and you want people to be able to authenticate to it, but you don't want to be in the business of operating your own authentication server. A couple reasons. One is that authentication is a hard problem. The other is that when you have an authentication service, it leads people to want to attack it and steal your user's credentials or, you know, otherwise bother them. If you don't operate your own authentication mechanism, that's not your problem. Right? The common acronym for that is SOC-P, some other company's problem. So if you have a nifty service, if you have the next WhatsApp, let's say, right, and you want to allow users to authenticate to your service without requiring that they provide you credentials, then what you want is a distributed authentication system, which is exactly what OAuth is. So it was designed by a bunch of internet companies to give them a broadly scaled, internet-friendly means of authenticating users of one service using somebody else's authentication service. I think this picture sums it up very nicely. If you go to Nike's website so that you can track your Nike Fuel or use their Nike Plus running tracker app or anything like that, you can create an account that is specific to Nike and use that account to log in, or you can just click the friendly blue login with Facebook button, right? Since almost every human on the planet over age 8 has got a Facebook account, this was a no-brainer for Nike, right? It also has a lot of really interesting implications in terms of tracking people's behavior across sites, and being able to build demographic profiles so that Facebook can sell your data to people and so on. I don't even want to get into that because I don't think that's what the OpenID and OAuth guys were after when they designed this. But the fact of the matter is that having an open distributed authentication system is really handy for lots of different circumstances, one of which is letting servers authenticate to each other. So if you think about what OAuth was originally for, it was designed to let JRandom internet user authenticate to some service using a third service's or second service's credentials. Well, we have exactly that same problem with these Office 2013 server apps. Because when you think about it, in Link, we've got this concept of a trusted application pool. If you put an object into that trusted app pool, what you are telling Link is accept traffic from that object, right? You're not telling Link, well, authenticate this object and then accept traffic from it. In the same vein with Exchange, if you designate an IP address or an FQDN for an Exchange UM IP gateway, you're telling Exchange, accept any SIP invite that you get from this IP address. You're not telling it to authenticate it or to make sure that it's from, you know, some device that you actually want to talk to. Why? Because we don't have a good way to authenticate servers that are not part of the same domain we're in. Now, what does that sound like? Well, it sounds to me like Office 365. Because what is 365? It's a multi-forest environment. Your stuff is in your forest. Microsoft stuff is in their forest. There are all these whiz-bang cross-forest synchronization and trust mechanisms that come into play to let you federate with Microsoft and do FreeBSD and do Edge Federation and so on. But ultimately, one of the things that has to go along with that is a way for me to authenticate a server in Microsoft's forest and vice versa. And Kerberos is just not sufficient. It has too many port restrictions. It is very finicky and brittle in multi-forest environments. It doesn't scale well, and it can't talk to anybody else, right? So OAuth, or server-to-server OAuth, which is a variant we actually care about in the context of these servers, solves all those problems. It's pure XML over HTTPS, which means it can go anywhere that port 443 is allowed. So we don't have any of the firewall or traffic shaping issues that we have with Kerberos traffic. Because it's an open standard that's published, everybody who wants to use it can use it. There are no royalties, there are no implementation limitations, there are no crypto limitations. For a while, as you probably know, Microsoft couldn't export full-strength crypto for Kerberos. But most importantly, it cuts through all of the cross-forest difficulties. Because when you get right down to it, authenticating a Nike user against Facebook is exactly the same thing as authenticating an on-prem Exchange server to talk to a Link server in the cloud, or vice versa. However, having said that, to make this work, Microsoft needed to add some extensions to the basic server-to-server OAuth protocol. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do this, but if you go to MSDN and you read these protocol documents, number one, you won't have any trouble getting to sleep that night. But number two, you'll see exactly what extensions Microsoft put into place, and they were primarily oriented at specifying which set of authentication algorithms and which set of crypto algorithms Microsoft server products expect to see, but also providing some extensions that you need to have when you're authenticating servers against each other that you don't care about when you're authenticating a user against a service. It's not necessary that we go into the detail of what's in these extensions in order to talk about OAuth at the level we want to, but I would point out, if you're only going to read one thing out of these documents, that section 3.2.5 in MS XOAuth is a pretty good description of actually what authentication payload gets passed around. And so if you're curious, you might start with that and see if that satiates your curiosity or makes you want to learn more about the protocol overall. The takeaway in terms of how OAuth works is to remember that we're passing tokens around just like we do in Kerberos. In Kerberos, we call them tickets. In OAuth land, we call them tokens. But they are the same thing. They're an object that one server issues to another that says, hey, look at this. Right? How many of you were able to get into the exhibit hall when it opened at 10:30? Right? Everybody who wanted to. Good luck trying to get in before that because those gate guards are pretty fierce. That is possible because you have a token that is issued by a trusted issuer so that when the verifier looks at the token and says, oh, look, hey, this guy's got a Link conference badge. It looks legit. And it does not have the no expo tag, I'm going to let this person in. So when one server requests authentication to another, what ends up happening is that there is an exchange of these encrypted tokens. They are encrypted and secured using certificates. When you install Exchange on a computer, you automatically get a self-signed certificate that is automatically assigned for the use of OAuth. That's an example of Exchange's philosophy of anytime we can automatically secure something, we will, and we'll let the administrator come along. She can change the certificate or she can change what happens later if she wants to. The Link side requires you to actually pick which certificate you're going to use and assign it, at which point Link replicates it. So there's a little bit of a philosophical difference between those two sides in that Exchange automatically wants to do things like install self-signed certs for TLS encryption of SMTP, whereas Link requires you to actually think about the certs you're going to use, pick which ones you want, and then set them for use. Not saying one approach is better or worse than the other, just that they're a little bit different. So one of the setup steps that you're probably catching on to right about now is that when you are first setting up a new 2013 server install, on the link side, you've got to use either import CS certificate or set CS certificate with that OAuth token issuer flag to tell Link, hey, this is a certificate that I want to use for OAuth. Now, it's really important you realize this. These certificates don't have to be the same as any certificate that you use for anything else, but they can be, because the only thing they're used for is securing these tokens as they're passed back and forth, right? So if you want to buy a single certificate and use it for everything on Exchange, totally free to do that. There's no real advantage to doing it because the self-signed cert works perfectly well and it's free, but you can. Okay, same thing on the Link side. The one restriction is that it is not officially supported to use wildcard certs for OAuth on Link. That raises a question of whether or not it's supposed to work. All I know is it doesn't, and it's not supported to it, which probably explains why it doesn't work. Now, I want to pivot from talking purely about OAuth as a sort of theoretical construct to talking about how it's implemented and used by these server apps. And I promise, I know this is not super exciting, but this lays the foundation for all the neat stuff that comes later, because we want, for example, our Link server to be able to silently, automatically authenticate to Exchange to put stuff in the unified contact store or to read a contact photo or do the other goodies. So in order to make it happen, we've got to have this authentication framework in place. So Office implements server-to-server OAuth using this concept of what it calls partner applications. These are families. These are not individual servers. So when you use the partner application management commandlet in Link to authorize Exchange as a partner app, you're actually authorizing all the Exchange servers in your forest. You're not authenticating, or you're not authorizing one individual server. You see the difference? When you add an Exchange server to a trusted app pool, you're saying this one right here is trusted. When you add Exchange as a partner application, you're saying all the Exchange servers in my forest are to be trusted, if they can authenticate. So you can think of this more as establishing the potential and saying it is okay to trust Exchange or it is okay to trust SharePoint if that server can authenticate, as opposed to saying just blindly trust that object to behave properly. So each of these server families has a URL on each individual server where it publishes some metadata that specifies in the format according to Microsoft spec that we talked about earlier, how they will accept and how they will generate authentication. So one thing that's really important to do early on in your deployment is make sure that you can reach those URLs. And I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. I just want to mention that as a prerequisite now so that you'll see what I'm talking about in a minute. So if you're going to have the full enchilada of Link, Exchange, and SharePoint 2013 all deployed and take advantage of all these integration features, then Link has to trust both Exchange and SharePoint. SharePoint has to trust both Exchange and Link. Exchange has to trust both of its partners. If you're not using SharePoint, for example, you don't have to worry about adding it as a partner app. Although Microsoft has a script that they make freely available on TechNet that will automatically set up all the partner apps for all the apps that you have, so that you don't have to worry about it. You run the script, whatever you have will be partnerized, and then you're done. But before you run that script, okay, which is linked down here at the bottom, you need to make sure that you can get to these two URLs for Exchange and for Link. The top one, and obviously, you know, you'll sub in your own FQDN instead of Contoso, but the top one is the URL where Exchange publishes its authentication metadata. The second one is where Link typically publishes it. So for Exchange, it will normally be published under the AutoDiscover virtual directory of the CAS servers in your org, which is, as you can see, why that URL is built the way that it is. For Link, it'll normally be published by a front-end pool. You can change those URL publishing points if you want to, but I've never seen a good reason to do it. Okay, I'm not saying there isn't one, just that nobody's ever come up with a convincing argument that made me say, okay, I can see why you'd want to do that. Once you verify that you actually can load the contents of that URL, then you can go ahead and authorize the partner applications. If you can't load those URLs, that tells you that something is jacked up on that particular server, and you need to figure out what it is and fix it. So when I say load the URL, what do I actually mean? Well, you should be able to type that URL into your browser of choice and see the XML manifest or the JSON manifest that gets delivered with no certificate warnings, no password prompts, no red icon in the certificate portion of the title bar. If you get any of those things, stop, figure out why, and fix them. 90% of the time, if that happens, it's going to be because you either don't have a certificate assigned, in which case, when you go to HTTPS, whatever, you're going to get 404'd, right? Or you will have a certificate, but there's something wrong with it. It's invalid, it's expired, it's self-signed, and the computer you're on doesn't like that, so on. All those things are very easy to fix. The point is that you have to check for them before you run Configure Partner Application or new CS Partner Application. In terms of what kinds of certificates are acceptable in this context, link is a little funny because it depends on mutual TLS. So for link to exchange, you need to have the FQDN of the exchange server both as a subject name and as a subject alt name in the certificate. Exchange, on the other hand, is, I hesitate to say promiscuous, let's just say it's not very picky. As long as the certificate validates, it doesn't really care what names are in the certificate name or SAN fields. Right? As long as the certificate is not on a CRL, not before its beginning date or after its end date, and has not been revoked, Exchange is happy. So if the first step in checking this is to make sure that you can load these URLs, the second step, once you have certificates in place, is to verify that on the link server you can load OWA from your Exchange CAS without getting errors, and that on your Exchange servers you can load Link Web App or the Link Meeting Console or whatever Link Web property you want to test against, all without getting any certificate errors. If you get a certificate error, figure out what it is and fix it. Doing it now will save you a ton of time later. Because if you don't have OAuth working, then these feature integration parts that we're going to talk about later, you can turn on integration, but the feature itself won't work. So you'll be wondering, okay, why don't I see high-res pictures? Or how come I don't see new contacts being added to UCS? Well, this is probably why. Keep in mind, too, that because Link uses CMS to replicate certificates, once you assign that cert, it's not going to be pushed to your Link servers until CMS replication is completed. Exchange, on the other hand, requires you to assign a certificate on every single server, which is part of the reason why it automatically does that as part of the install process. The reason that this comes into play is if you change that certificate so that you're not using the self-signed cert and you want to use the same certificate on every server, then you have to manually go through and run Enable Exchange Certificate to reset or to change the certificate that you have assigned on all of your other servers. Whereas with Link, once you pick the certificate and publish to CMS and it replicates, that change is made for you. Okay, I know you're all thinking, Lord, I hope Paul is done talking about OAuth. Not quite. Once you've got it working and you're confident in it, should you test it? Yes, you should always test it. That's why we have all these test commandlets in LMS and EMS. On the Exchange side, there is a specific commandlet called test OAuth connectivity that you can run that will tell you whether Exchange is able to make an OAuth connection to Link. Now, it's not a guarantee of 100% certainty, but the odds are really, really good. If you can run this commandlet on Exchange and not get any errors, the odds that your Link server is going to be able to OAuth back to Exchange are really high. Okay, so what I tell people as an absolute rule, before you get ready to turn on any of these features or proceed any further, you install Exchange and configure it, you install Link and configure it, then you do the OAuth setup before you do anything else. You don't provision any users, you don't turn on any connectors, you don't federate. Run test OAuth connectivity, and when you are satisfied with its results, then you can proceed to actually take advantage of the new features and start getting your new feature on. Let's start with UCS. Okay, this is a great example of the underlying power of the data that's in Exchange. How many of you were surprised yesterday when Gurdeep was talking about the possibility that we'll have servers or clients that can predict what we're going to do or predict what's going to happen, right? On the one hand, that kind of creeps me out. On the other hand, I like the idea that my client will learn from watching me then when I get an email from certain people, the client knows I'm going to respond to it very quickly. And so it's going to prioritize those emails to get them in front of me faster. We already have some tools for doing that. We have Outlook rules. How many of you are using iPhones? Okay. How many of you who are using iPhones use the VIP feature that Apple's included to prioritize mail from some people so that it shows up differently, you get different alerting, right? So the next step is for our clients and servers to be able to look at the data we've got and look at what we do with it and make decisions about what we are likely to want or not want. Well, it turns out that contact data is this really rich source of all kinds of useful information about who we interact with and when and how. But the way that Exchange and Link are designed in 2010, that contact information is in two completely separate stovepipes. Now, that's understandable because the metadata we care about for a contact in Exchange and the metadata we care about for a contact in Link are very different. In Link, we have things like the privacy level of a contact. You know, are they part of our team? Are they part of the company? Can they interrupt us? Are they tagged for status change alerts? Whereas on the Exchange side, we have metadata that is more, I guess, people-oriented. What's this person's birthday? We have a notes field. We have the ability to tag, you know, when somebody's anniversary is so that it shows up in the calendar. What Unified Contact Store does is move those Link contacts and their metadata over into the same container where we're already keeping our Exchange contacts. Now, there's actually a separate Link contacts folder that gets created in the user's mailbox by UCS. So our Link contacts are not thrown into the same pot as the Exchange contacts are, but at least they're in the pots are in the same cabinet at this point, which means that if Microsoft were working on some kind of super whiz-bang assistant feature, let's say, that was supposed to learn by our interactions and figure out how to prioritize contacts, it would be really handy to have all those contacts in the same container so that the assistant could use them in a unified way. So that's what we're getting toward. To make this happen, we have a new component called LIS, the Link Storage Service. This is a piece of middleware that runs on Link 2013 and will branch writes and reads either to SQL Server, which is our default storage mechanism, or to the Unified Contact Store. So the beauty of that is that as a Link administrator, as a Link user, as an Exchange administrator, you have nothing to do with what LIS does. It will automatically figure out whether you have UCS enabled, whether it's turned on for a particular user, whether that user is capable of using it or not because they have the right version of the client and their mailbox and Link are homed on the right versions, and it will automatically take care of intermediating those writes and reads for you. I shouldn't ask for a show of hands. Just think to yourself how often you have run into a case where you had somebody damage something in your environment by messing around with SQL in Link. Yes, I see one hand. I can't see the person. I can just see the hand up in the air in the back because they're sitting on the floor. This eliminates that problem and substitutes with it the problem that your Exchange administrator will get in and break something by messing around with X folders or the EWS editor or something. But that's a little bit less likely. The way that this actually works is that we get the visible Link contacts folder, which is just an Exchange contacts folder. There's nothing unique about it in terms of how Exchange stores or interacts with the objects that are in that folder. But we also get a hidden folder in the mailbox where the Link metadata is stored. So the interesting thing about this storage architecture is that these objects are in the mailbox. That means you can have redundant copies of them if you're using database availability groups. It means that when you move the mailbox from one server to another, or when you fail it from one server to another, all this Link data goes right along with the rest of the mailbox. So when you think about what that means in terms of resiliency and availability, wouldn't it be great if a Link front-end server had no user data at all on it, so that there was absolutely nothing unique about it? Let me ask you a question. What do you think happens if you go down to the front desk here at the hotel and you say, hey, the phone in my room doesn't work? Do you think they spend any time trying to troubleshoot it, or do they just send engineering with a new phone to your room, plug in the new phone, and off you go? Well, what should happen is that they should take the phone down to the slingshot, right? But when you think about what has to happen, everything that phone knows about the network is on the network. It's not in the phone. That's what we would eventually like to get to for these front-end servers that clients talk to. Exchange is well on the way there with the client access architecture we have in 2013. And this helps move Link in that direction too, because now our user contact data is not on the Link server. It's in Exchange. If that Link server blows up, who cares? Restore it from a snapshot, spin up another VM, reinstall Link. You know, how you restore it doesn't matter. But you don't have to worry about restoring any unique data to the server because there isn't any. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting closer. So if that's what it's supposed to do, let's talk about how it actually does it. First off, no changes on Exchange. So as an Exchange guy, I approve this message. All that you have to do is turn it on the Link side, and if you have a compatible client who has the right policy set, those contacts will just magically start flowing into Exchange. And as I said before, they're just contact objects. Exchange treats them like every other contact. So there are no changes required on the Exchange storage side or on the Exchange client side. Now, you may have the case where you see odd behavior from the Link contacts folder on individual clients. I'm looking at you, iOS. Okay, anybody remember when the suggested contacts folder was first introduced? What happened? Clients that didn't know, they were not written to be smart about which contacts they included in auto-suggest or auto-complete, would often pull in these suggested contacts. So if you ever sent mail, even one time, to somebody like your son's fifth grade teacher or, you know, some marketing person that you met at Link Conference, next thing you know, that person's name is indelibly in your contacts folder. It's showing up on your mobile devices and so on. So to try to fix that, clients are supposed to be smarter about not using the Link contacts folder unless they have a reason to use it because they're a Link client. Doesn't mean that it's not accessible to other clients, just that we are all hopeful that the mobile mail and phone clients on, you know, mobile devices are not going to get in there and start rooting around. Anyway, if you want to enable this, it requires that you set a policy for your users, either at the global site or user level, to let them have it. Once that policy is in place, actually even before that policy is in place, every time you launch a Link 2013 client, how many of you went to Brian Rix's Link client sign-in session this morning? It was really good. I had to leave because I had to come do a tech check, but if you didn't get a chance, he's repeating it tomorrow. It's top-notch. He talks in great detail about the process that goes on for the client to find which server it should talk to and then start communicating with it. So when you fire up the client, at some point after all the mating dance that Brian describes has taken place, then the Link client is going to send a header to the server that says, hey, I support UCS. In other words, I have the ability to use Exchange Web Services to go find my contacts. And if that user is enabled by Link policy, and if their mailbox is on Exchange 2013, and if their Link presence is homed on a Link 2013 pool, then the front end that they're talking to will take that user's contacts and contact metadata out of the SQL store and use lists to start writing it into the unified contacts folder. Once that happens, this is the one thing that I dislike about UCS. The user will get a message that says basically, hey, your administrator made a change and you have to restart the Link client. If you've ever seen that on the Outlook side, you know that's like a huge generator of support calls, because when users see that, it sounds unusual, and the wording that says your administrator has made a change invites them to pick up the phone and say, hey, administrator, why did you do that? So you'll get a message from the Link client that says, okay, your contacts have been migrated, relaunch Link, and then once you do that, boom, you will be using UCS. How do you know that that's happened? Well, there are a couple of ways that I'm going to talk about when we get to integration. I forgot I reordered these slides, so we have to talk about archiving first. How many of you are using archiving with Link right now? Okay, at first I thought nobody was going to raise their hands. I was like, man, that's cold. How many of you drive electric cars? Okay, if you don't drive an electric car, do you care about where you can plug in an electric car to charge it? Generally not. So if you're not using archiving, most of the time you don't care what archiving features exist, because if you needed it, then you would care. So for those of you who do care, or for at least academic completeness, I want to spend a few minutes talking about archiving. One of the big bets Microsoft made a few years ago was that they bought FAST, the archiving and indexing company. And they bought it because their own search technology was weak by comparison. Luckily, they bought FAST and not Autonomy. right? Anyway, moving right along. Microsoft made this bet that by buying fast and making search technology a better integrated part of their enterprise server products, that they would be able to find lots of nifty new scenarios that that would enable. And it turns out archiving is one of them. If you think about what has to happen during a typical discovery search in an archive, at a minimum, you have to be able to search people's SharePoint document collections. You have to be able to search your email. You have to be able to search public folders. And you might want to be able to search their conferences and IM traffic as well. Do you actually have to search all of those things? It depends on your policy. But Microsoft wanted to create an ecosystem. Ecosystem is the wrong word because that implies partners. They wanted to create a biosphere, let's say, or a bubble where if you had all Microsoft products and you turned on archiving, you could search across all of those Microsoft repositories without having to have a third-party product. That's what they were going for. Because for the 80% case, and here I'm not talking about companies that have that are securities traders or pharmaceutical companies or other very heavily regulated industries, but for the average company, what do they need to be able to do? They need to be able to put in search criteria that says, okay, we're getting sued by somebody and we want to find all the mail and documents that are relevant to that, but that doesn't happen very often, right? We need to be able to take a set of mailboxes and a set of documents and protect them so that they can't be changed during the pendency of this lawsuit. A few other very simple things like that. Of course, when I say they're simple, the devil is in the details. But the core functionality that Microsoft is trying to get to is enough for a large percentage of their customers. If you have higher-end needs, and you buy a higher-end discovery product, right? But for the base customer requirements, just being able to search across all these data sources is a big deal. So with the 2013 wave of products, what we get is the ability to search linked data the same way that we search Exchange data. And that's enabled by putting that linked data into Exchange. Now, it sounds a little counterintuitive at first. We already have the ability to archive individual linked conversations to the conversation history folder, unless you're on a Mac, right? Sword point. Maybe they'll fix that someday. Anyway, the problem with putting things in conversation history is what? People can delete them. That's exactly right. If you have an inconvenient conversation or one that you would prefer that your company not have a record of, you just hit delete and then it's gone, right? Okay, that's not so great from a compliance standpoint. When people have the freedom to delete whatever they want to, that's great for them, but it's not so great for you from a legal and regulatory perspective. So by putting this link communications data into the same mechanism that Exchange uses for archiving, it means that when we want to, we have some pretty powerful tools for retaining data even when the user would prefer that it be gone. So Link enables that by giving us a choice of four sets of controls or four policy controls that govern where this data goes. The first is to say the policy is uninitialized or the destination is uninitialized. What that means is if a user is on hold in Exchange, if they're being required to retain stuff in Exchange, Exchange will control what gets archived. But Link has nothing to do with that. Either Exchange archiving is on or it's off, and Link settings don't come into play. This is kind of like the option in a GPO where you can have something that's either enabled, disabled, or leave it alone, and whatever's there, honor that policy. Then we can force the use of Link's policy, we can force the use of Exchange's policy, or we can affirmatively block archiving from happening. I have customers who say, great, we're going to archive all of our Exchange stuff. We don't want to archive IAMs. Okay, if that's your legal team's decision about what they think they should archive, Link gives you a way to do that. If you have an existing Link archiving system, you can continue to use Link archiving if you want to, or you can spill your archive traffic to Exchange, which makes sense when you think about the way that Exchange archiving holds work. So Link's mechanism is basically to take this data and put it somewhere where a real third-party archiving system can get to it. Exchange used to do that, too, through journaling, which is a mechanism that just captures copies of the messages and passes them somewhere else for an external system to archive and safeguard. What we have now is the ability to, Exchange uses the word hold, okay? Maybe freeze is a better word, because when you put somebody on hold, you are preserving items so that they can't be changed. You can do that using one of three sets of criteria. You can say that you want that hold to be based on time, that you want it to be based on content, or that you want it to be indefinite. So when you think about this, this actually is a really cool way to integrate keeping linked data alongside everything else. If I put somebody's mailbox on indefinite litigation hold, that means that although they can go into the client and they can delete messages or edit messages, those changes are actually persisted in a folder that they can't see and can't edit. What do I mean by that? Well, let's say that I have a message from my boss with something incriminating in it, right? And I look at that message and I'm like, damn, I'm pretty sure he didn't mean to send that. I'm just going to go ahead and delete it so nobody gets into trouble. And my mailbox is on hold. When I hit delete, that message disappears from Outlook and it looks like I deleted it. But in the purges folder, that message still exists. And there's nothing I can do to get rid of it, which is exactly what you want in a hold mechanism. You don't want the user necessarily to know that his mailbox is being preserved, but you certainly don't want him to be able to make permanent changes to it when it's under preservation. So think about what this means from a link standpoint. Now, if I've got link IM and CDR traffic and conference traffic, it's being put into the same mechanism that Exchange uses. So when I put somebody on hold, all of their data goes on hold. If I say you're on a time-based hold so that I can look at your archive for the last 120 days and you can't change it, that ought to apply to their link traffic as well as to their mailbox data, right? That may not be the case, as I said, if your policy doesn't allow you or requires you not to keep link traffic. But in many cases, what you want is you want to preserve every single record because that's what your regulatory or compliance folks expect you to do. And so that's what this does. Now, another thing that's really cool about this is that Exchange has got a very, very granular set of RBAC permissions for doing discovery searches. Because typically, the Exchange administrators are not the one who are doing the searches. It's the legal team or the HR team or some other group of people. So without having to give those people any permissions into link at all, now they can do discovery searches that include data that was generated by link. So what we're really doing with this archiving mechanism is just taking the data that's already being generated by link and just putting it in the same place that some other useful data is so that we have a unified way to get to it. Now let's move on to something that's a little more showy. Yeah?
Question about that. So the link data is only held in the purges folders when a hold policy is set in Exchange, or is the link data, I thought it was constantly rolling through the purges folders subject to the same retention time.
It depends on which of those archiving options you selected. If you have a user who is enabled for link archiving and you have link set to use Exchange archiving, then that data will go to purges, but then it'll be aged out.
Subject to the normal retention.
Yeah, right. Okay. Right. If you put them on hold, the minute you put them on hold, their link data is on hold just like their Exchange data would be. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, but the data always goes into the purges folder in the first place when Exchange archiving is turned, or sorry, when link is told to use Exchange as an archiving mechanism. Right. I want to make sure I don't say Exchange archiving is on, because to an Exchange guy like you, that means something completely different. Yes. Yes, that's a good point. This doesn't have anything to do with Exchange personal archives, with that feature that gives you a separate archive mailbox that you can sweep stuff into or manually put stuff in. Good call. So I talked earlier about, you know, this idea that if we have a really high-res fancy LRS, it's a shame to crap it up with crayon pictures. But that's what we've had for a long while. And, you know, those of you who have been around a while remember how cool it was when we got these 96 by 96 thumbnails. It was like, wow, look, I can see Joe. Is that Joe? Yeah, I think that's Joe. Right? So having that was a lot better than nothing. Right? But they still don't look great. On the other hand, you know, technically it has been possible to put larger, higher resolution photos in AD, but the AD people really hate that. They hate it at Microsoft and the operating AD teams at every customer I've ever been to. Man, one of the first questions they ask when we start talking about deploying Link, oh yeah, I heard that, doesn't it put pictures in the gal? You know, that's going to make our DIT go from, you know, 1 gigabyte to 1.1 gigabyte. We can't do that, right? So since Exchange is already storing, you know, tens of gigabytes of data for user mailboxes, what is it going to hurt to put a couple of hundred Ks worth of picture data in there? Well, nothing. So with high-res photos, we have the ability now to through Exchange, load a picture into a user mailbox that Exchange will automatically propagate both to AD and then make available to Link. Okay? So you put in a photo at whatever resolution you have. If it's bigger than 648 by 648, it'll be downsampled to that size. And then Exchange will downsample it to, I meant to look this up yesterday, I don't remember if it's 11 or 12 other resolutions besides 648 by 648. So when you put a picture in using this mechanism, it automatically goes into thumbnail photo, which means that legacy clients that still use thumbnail photo will automatically see that photo. But it also makes it available at other resolutions. So if you went to Jeff's session yesterday about video resolution, or if you were during the keynote yesterday noticing how on different devices we get different resolutions according to what the device is capable of, same thing happens here. An individual device or an individual client can ask for a picture in any one of these resolutions and get it back to customize the appearance for a device that has, I can't remember what the Nokia 920 is. It's like, I think, 1280 by 800 or something like that. If you have a device that has a bigger screen or a smaller screen, you might want a higher or lower resolution photo, and Exchange is going to give all those to you. The beauty of this to me is that this is not something that administrators have to do. Users upload their own photos. Now, there is a drawback to that, which is that users upload their own photos. And you don't know if the user is going to upload a photo of that would be appropriate for an employee badge, or a picture of his butt, or a picture of her dog. I mean, you know, there's no way to tell what users are going to put in there. But since these photos are becoming more ubiquitous throughout the Microsoft clients, it's a pretty safe bet if anybody puts up an unflattering or stupid or inappropriate photo, everybody's going to see it and they will be shamed into taking it down pretty quickly. Or report it to HR, one of those two. So the easy mechanisms for doing this right now are to upload it through ECP, right, which is what you see here. I'm actually looking at the account settings in Outlook web app for my account, and I've uploaded a photo which Exchange will propagate for me once I click that Save button. Until I click Save, the photo is there in Exchange, but it's not visible to anybody else, which is exactly what happens if you use Set User Photo to post a photo for somebody else. So if you want to, you as an administrator have the ability to upload photos, which means you have the ability to automatically script uploading photos from another system like PeopleSoft, where you already got badge photos or security photos stored. So if what you want is to take your existing badge photos and put them into Link, you can do that. If you want to let people upload their own photos, it shows them on vacation or playing the saxophone or, you know, doing something a little more human than the normal stone-faced badge expression, you can do that too. The real beauty of this feature is that's all there is to it. You put the picture in, and it's available. There's nothing to administer. There's nothing to set. There's no PowerShell. There's no nothing. Yeah?
How good is it, ECP, at resizing those photos to, you know, if I upload a, you know, 20-megabyte photo?
So it's got an upload size limit. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head, but it'll tell you. Yeah, the upload will fail if you take, so like if I take a native picture out of my Nikon and post it, it's going to say, hey, dummy, that file's too big. Right.
It's not very good at resizing them, so all the time they're like, my photo doesn't show up, and then you have to go check the AD thumbnail, and then you're like, oh, it's not there, so it didn't sync from SharePoint. So you think maybe this works a little better than that process?
Yes.
Okay.
This would be...
This
would be a great opportunity for me to say something rude about SharePoint, but I'm going to refrain in the spirit of, you know, brotherly cooperation between products. So remember earlier I said I was going to show you some diagrams with boxes, right? Microsoft loves these for architecture diagrams. And I stole this one from Jens. So if you don't like the boxes, pass that on to him. This is what integration looked like in Exchange 2010 and Link 2010. Notice what integration we have. IM and OWA, and that's it. Now look at what it looks like in the 2013 products. All of a sudden, we have all these other boxes. On the server side, on the left of the diagram, we have server-to-server OAuth that's used as a layer to let these other services authenticate to Exchange. Then underneath that, we have code on the Link server that talks to UCS. It does HR or high-resolution photo fetches, that handles archiving. And there's some other boxes under here. The point of having it laid out this way is to try to give you a rough idea of which clients use which access mechanisms and consume which services. But to me, the really interesting thing, and I can't find my laser pointer. Now, where's the laser button? really interesting thing here is that all of these terminate at the same place. All of this data is going into and out of Exchange through Exchange Web Services, which is a big deal. Notice there's no MAPI there. So all of these services can run perfectly fine through firewalls as long as you allow port 443 to pass and as long as you have EWS published properly. Then that eliminates a lot of the requirement we used to have for VPN connections or for direct network connections, not only between the client and the server, but between the servers in your data center and the servers in Microsoft's data center. Right? So this is another manifestation of how Microsoft is moving to protocols that let them separate on-prem and their cloud services to give you hybrid capability. So with that said, I mean, I just wanted to throw this up to give you a quick visual picture of how these feature components work together. It's a lot more interesting to actually talk about how you set them up and enable them to work, although for some of them, like high-risk photos, there's really nothing that you actually have to do. That's my favorite kind of feature. I like it when stuff just works. Let Microsoft do the hard work so I don't have to. So a high-level overview of how this works. Make sure OAuth is working. Make sure you have all the certificates in place that you should have and that they are functional. Decide what features you're going to turn on. Turn them on. Test them. There should be a sixth step up here that you'll go to Vegas for a vacation. Right? Maybe that's step one. I'm not really sure. Although I think most people who haven't been to a Link or MEC conference misunderstand what kind of vacation it is, because it's not easy to sit in these sessions and think about stuff all day. Right? I'm always ready for a couple of days of being away from people and doing non-technical stuff after I leave one of these conferences. Anyway, enough about me. Let's talk about Exchange. To configure the partner apps, we've already talked about that. Right? Fundamental is get OAuth working, and then once you've done that, enable the partner apps. You only have to do that once. You will only ever have to do it once. I can't promise that when we get Exchange, you know, 20-whatever and Link 20-whatever, because everybody heard that, right? There is a new version of on-prem Link coming. Microsoft has previously said there is a new version of on-prem Exchange coming. They ain't said nothing about the version after that, but at least we know we've got one more on-prem round coming for those two products. So this may change in the future, but at least for right now, you only have to do this once per deployment. If you want Exchange to be able to answer phone calls from Link, that's a completely separate work stream from what we're talking about here, because that involves call routing and involves setting up Exchange UM and the objects that it depends on, and then making Link route calls to it. Whether you're doing it on-prem or hybrid, doesn't matter. Setup process is the same, and it's outside the scope of what we're talking about here for the most part. Verify your certificates. Verify that you can connect from one side to the other without getting any certificate errors. Then there's another test commandlet that I want you to run. Test CSX storage connectivity. So on the Exchange side, that's the only place where we have an OAuth tester. On the Link side, that's the only place where we have a means to test not only that we can OAuth from Link back to Exchange, but also that we can write items into Exchange storage. So if you run this commandlet and it passes those tests, what that tells you is that everything is set up properly for Link to authenticate to an individual user mailbox and put data into it or take data out of it, which is what all these features rely on, right? Archiving puts data into a user mailbox. Unified Contact Store puts data into a user mailbox. High-risk photos are a little different. They get data out of a mailbox, but that's not authenticated. Right? As you'll see in a minute, if you know the URL, or sorry, if you know the SMTP address of the user whose picture you want, it's just a simple URL request. You can use Exchange Web Services to get it if you want to, but if you're writing your own app or you're trying to tie this functionality in with another web app that already exists, it's probably going to be easier just to use the URL and leave it at that. So once you pass the storage connectivity test, then you can go through and configure these features to work the way that you actually want them to. Now, I said earlier on that I was not going to talk a lot about Exchange UM integration. I do want to mention it very briefly, mostly to say that that's all I talked about in 401, and so you should go back and review that recording if that's a topic that's important to you. But in terms of the integration that you have to do, it has nothing to do with OAuth at all. You don't have to configure OAuth to use UM. The UM server and the Link server do not authenticate to each other in any way. Having said that, the one area where we do care is that Link requires the use of TLS, whereas Exchange does not. So if you want Link and Exchange to be able to talk to each other, you have to set the Exchange UM services to use what they call dual startup mode or secure mode. By default, they run in insecure mode, which means they don't use TLS, which means Link will refuse to talk to them. Other than that, these integration steps are completely separate from everything else we've talked about. So you can forget this slide now, and we'll drive on. So far, everything that I've talked about, except for the preceding slide, was all new stuff. But there are some changes to the way that we do integration between IM and Presence and Outlook Web App. That's an existing function that we've had since 2010, but the way you configure it in a 2013 environment is different. In fact, if you have Exchange 2013 with Link 2010, you still need to know this trick, because the way that you configure this on the Exchange side is different, even though it has not changed on the Link side. The basic architecture is still the same. There's a service that runs on the Exchange client access server called the OWA IM endpoint service that acts like a Link client. So when you log into your mailbox and you see OWA, if that service is running, it will log you into the Link server, let you change your presence, show you your contact list, route instant messages to your OWA window, and so on. If that service is not running, if it's running but it can't connect to the Link server because Link has been told not to talk to it, or because it has a wrong certificate, or any number of other reasons, OWA will work just fine. But instead of actually seeing the presence and contact information that you should be seeing, it'll be missing. So what do you have to do to configure this? Well, the first is that now, in a stunning improvement of technology, instead of having this easy-to-use PowerShell commandlet, now we have to go back to editing a text file using a text editor like it was 1972. And God help you if you miss a bracket or you accidentally hit an extra key in the middle of your XML somewhere, because then all kinds of stuff will break and you won't know why. Not that I've done that and I'm still mad about it or anything. I'm just saying. So when you edit that file, number one, always make a backup copy of web.config before you do anything. Yeah, Bargav. Yes, that's an excellent point. When you apply a cumulative update, Exchange will stomp all over that like a drunk in the gutter, and there's nothing you can do about that except make a backup copy of webconfig so that you have the change, because I guarantee you, as sure as stink, what will happen is that you'll make this change, and you'll forget that you made it, and 6 months from now, when you install a service pack or a cumulative update, all of a sudden, IAM and Presence integration goes away, and you won't know why, because you won't remember that you made this configuration change. Because this is simple enough to do, 5 minutes after you've done it, you'll probably forget it. It sounds like a DirecTV commercial, right? When you forget to update your OWA configuration, then you end up in Vegas with a tattoo on your face, right? I'll let you guys fill out the causal chain between those. Right. Well, it's a little different on the Link side, because they've actually got, when you install a Link CU, there are update processes you have to run to update the database and do a bunch of other stuff. But on the Exchange side, when you install a CU, Exchange has always sort of acted like nothing bad will happen, right? What happens in reality, it's gone all the way back to like Exchange 5. If you have any customizations on your server, they're gone. Forget it. Make backup copies. So because you've made a backup copy of this file before you edit it and ideally after you edit it to protect you, then the risk of you mistyping one of these things is fairly low. But when you look at what you have to do, you're really just adding two items. You're adding this IAM certificate thumbprint, which is a thumbprint of the cert that you want Exchange to offer to Link for mutual authentication. And you're adding the name of the Link pool that you want that particular Exchange server to talk to. You can have every Exchange client access server talk to the same Link pool, but that's not a requirement. Having said that, I'll just go ahead and tell you now. If you make this change, let's say you have two client access servers. You make this change on one, you don't make the change on the other. When a user logs into the other server, they still get OWA, but they don't get IAM and Presence integration. You have to make this change everywhere that you want users to have this. Now, you may find that you have some users that you want to corral onto a client access server where this integration is not available because you don't want them to have it, and that's fine. But if you neglect to make this change on a server, then you're not going to get that behavior. Now, this gives me fits. I hope they fix it in Service Pack 1, but I haven't checked. The first time you configure this, you have to both turn on instant messaging integration with instant messaging enabled, but you also have to set the instant messaging type to OCS. The whole reason there's a type field is that back in ancient days of Live at EDU, which some of you may remember, Live at EDU could federate with MSN Messenger. Anybody remember Messenger? I mean, come on, it hadn't been gone that long. Skype Junior, right? Messenger was Skype Junior, then we have Skype, and now Link is going to become Skype Pro, right? That's what's going to happen. Anyway, and I guess Exchange will be Skype Email when this all gets done. If you don't set that type field, which is blank by default, then even though you've done everything else properly, when the IM endpoint mapper starts up, it will try to figure out what type of IM service it should talk to, and when it sees that that field is blank, it'll say, oh, well, I guess I'm not supposed to talk to anybody, and it'll shut down again. And so if you follow the examples in Microsoft's documentation, which don't say a damn thing about this field, and do your setup, you will find that you don't get any errors, but it doesn't work until you turn up diagnostic logging and look in the event log, and then it will say, I don't know what IM type I'm supposed to be, so I'm just not going to do anything. Now, a word about the trusted application pool. I mentioned this earlier as the object type that Link uses to specify that some endpoint ought to be able to inject traffic into Link. So in 2013, Microsoft did something that I think they thought was helpful. They added this topology discovery element that will go out and find Exchange servers and automatically add them to a trusted application pool. The problem is that if you add the same server twice to the same trusted application pool, Link really doesn't like that, and it will refuse to talk to that server object. So if the topology discovery module has added your Exchange servers and then you manually add them as the documentation tells you to, they'll be in there twice and stuff won't work. But the case where they're automatically added is if they are combined client access and mailbox servers, or if you have a server that has a SIP dial plan on it. Now, that should cover like 90% of the cases where you're doing this integration, especially now that Microsoft is really fierce about telling us all to have multi-role CAS and mailbox servers. But let's say that for some reason you've separated those roles or you have servers that don't have SIP dial plans. The topology discovery engine will not add these servers to the pool, so you have to do it yourself. But if you don't realize that and you add them to the pool yourself anyway, IAM and presence integration will stop working. So to fix that, what you do is you just take them out of the pool again. Okay? It's not a big deal, and you'll very quickly learn to check this when you're adding a new server, but it's kind of frustrating the first, I don't know, 10 times that it bites you. It really only got me about 6 times before I caught on. Yeah?
So just to confirm, that will work with Exchange.
Yeah, because the topology discovery engine is only in Link 2013. So you still have to add Exchange 2013 servers to the Link 2010. Oh, yeah. No, integration will work fine. Right? The Exchange app that talks to Link will talk to Link 2010 without any difficulty. Unified Contact Store, basically nothing for you to do on the Exchange side. And on the Link side, the only thing you have to do is set a user services policy for the users you want to have this that enables it. But remember, users will only be able to do this if 3 things are true. They have to have the Link 2013 client. Notice I didn't say anything about the Windows Store client or the Mac client or mobile clients. It's got to be Link 2013 full client. Link Basic doesn't do it. So Link 2013 with the user homed on a Link 2013 pool and the user's mailbox on Exchange 2013. If you set them up with those 3 conditions and enable them for UCS and then later you move them to a different configuration, maybe you move their mailbox back to 2010, then you have to roll back their UCS access. If you look for UCS rollback, if you bang that, you'll find the article that tells you how to do it. It's trivial, so I'm not going to talk about it here. How do you know that this has been done? Well, it depends. It'll happen when the server has time to make it happen, so it's not going to be instantaneous, but it generally will not take longer than a couple of hours. You'll know that it's been done when you look in the user's Outlook client and you see that their link contacts folder is present. Okay, there are also some events that get logged in a link trace to tell you that user X has been migrated. The other way that you can tell, and I like this better because it doesn't require you to verify that Outlook is online, not in cached mode, that, you know, anything along those lines, is if you right-click the link icon in the taskbar and show the configuration information, you'll see this contact list provider will show up as Exchange Server. So this is a screenshot from a lab environment that doesn't have UCS enabled, which is why it says Link Server. Okay, if this user had been UCS enabled and was using UCS, it'll only say Exchange if the user has the ability to have UCS and they have also migrated, or their contacts have been migrated. Okay, so this is a really quick way to check and see whether an individual user has got that. High-res photos, the only thing you have to think about from an integration standpoint here is that if the users don't have the RBAC rights to modify their own profile information, they may not be able to upload their own photo. Some organizations are really firm about not allowing users to customize their profile information through OAuth options. Others allow it. If you don't allow it, you won't be able to do this unless you restore some of those privileges to users by giving them a new user assignment role, or sorry, user role assignment. Now, this is really key, this last bullet. Photos are retrieved via EWS. If there's anything blocking EWS traffic, you won't see these photos. Well, how would you know? Think about all the other things that the link client uses EWS for, right? It uses it for free busy, it can use it for the address book, it uses it for voicemail notification. If you have any of those things that don't work when your link client is outside the firewall, then high-res photo fetch isn't going to work either because it depends on EWS. The good news is that it's really simple to tell whether that's a problem or not because you can always, oh, darn it, that's not the next slide. So I have a slide coming up in a minute that shows the URL format. Trivial 10-second check from a client to see whether it can fetch that photo is to type in the URL where the photo lives and see whether you get a photo or not, right? The other way that you can do it, if you look in this configuration, you'll see, if I can find it, you'll see the EWS URLs that the link client sees. Brian talks about that in his session at some length, about how Link Discover discovers EWS resources. But the bottom line is if your link client cannot find EWS, you won't see those high-res photos. You'll get the little blue silhouette instead. Okay, we're finally going to get to answer Sean's question about archiving, but he already left, so too bad. You can set link to archive three different ways. One is don't archive anything. One is use SQL Server, which is what we had in 2010, or you can have it use Exchange. So to do that, there's a combination of two things that you have to enable. One is you have to, and you can think of this like plugging in archiving. You have to tell Link, hey, I want you to use Exchange to archive stuff, and I want you to archive whatever, where's my mouse, whatever particular stuff you want. So in this case, I am in WebConf, I am only, WebConf only, whatever. So what this does, when you run set CS archiving configuration, that enables Link. It gives it permission to archive stuff if the user has an archive policy enabled. So that's the other thing. This is a server level or policy level configuration that makes it possible for archiving to occur. And this is a policy for a specific user that says, yes, archive John's stuff, archive Michael's stuff, archive Paul's stuff. Okay. Without both of those, if you turn archiving on the user but not on the archiving configuration, nothing will happen. And if you enable the archiving configuration but don't turn it on for a particular user, that particular user's stuff will not be archived. Okay, so keep that in mind. I've seen multiple cases where one or the other of those things didn't happen, and then people were unhappy when they noticed that so-and-so's traffic was not being archived properly. The good news is that because Link has already got a single unified global archive configuration, all you've got to do is run set CS archiving configuration on the global policy, turn on Exchange archiving, and boom, you're done. Then it's just a matter of turning it on for the users that you want to have it. You can do that globally. You can do that by site. You can do it by individual user. Or if you want to get really exotic, you can create your own archiving policy and then grant it to the users you want to have. The cool thing about this, it's exactly the same as every other kind of user policy in Link. There's nothing magical about it. If you understand how archiving works in plain Link, it works exactly the same way with Exchange. It's just that the repository where the archive data goes is different. Does that make sense to everybody? I like features like this because they tie together something you already know with a new capability. You don't have to know anything more about archiving than you know right now to be able to use Exchange as your archive sync. Now, let's talk a little bit about the hybrid world. Because heaven help us, that seems to be where Microsoft is sending us all, whether we want to go there or not, right? There are a couple of different possible combinations, but the one I see most often at customers is on-prem link and Exchange UM, well, sorry, not just Exchange UM, but Exchange Online. Why? Phones. People want to be able to use PSTN. So now that we are going to have Link Business Voice, it's going to be really interesting to me to see what influence that has on the mix of which hybrid models people pick. Okay, we'll wait and see. I'll come back at Link Conference next year. And if I were brave, I would make a prediction now and then come back next year and we'd see if I was right or not. But I don't know enough to be able to tackle that at this point. I think it's probably true that we will see more Exchange on-prem with Link Online, or sorry, we will see more Exchange on-prem with Link Online than we do now, but not as much as we do Exchange Online with Link on-prem. In part because people who are now deploying that, for example, I have a customer that's got almost 70,000 seats that they're moving to Exchange Online, and they're moving from same time to Link on-prem. They're doing that in calendar 2014. I guarantee you next year they're not going to be moving to Link Online. Right? Microsoft cannot throw enough money at them to make them interested in going through that transition 2 years in a row. So they might be a great fit for this, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to drink the Kool-Aid. Anyway, this is not the hybrid session, so I don't want to go into a lot of philosophical discussion about hybrid config. The big things to keep in mind for these hybrid configurations are where the OAuth endpoints are and what that means about who authenticates to what. When you think about it, a hybrid model and a hosted model are exactly the same thing from the perspective of these servers. So if you have a hybrid model where you have on-prem Exchange talking to Link in the cloud, that's the same as far as these servers are concerned with having two forests that belong in the same organization or having Intermedia running Exchange for you while you run Link on-prem. It's all server-to-server OAuth. So be thinking about what that means in terms of how you define the realms that OAuth authenticates to. It also means you need to spend some time thinking about how you set up Link how or if you need to set up Link Federation to enable hosted voice. Sorry, hosted voicemail. If you could enable hosted voice, then we'd all be in the cloud now already anyway, right? So I put these URLs in here not because I expect you to read them or transcribe them in real time, but because they'll be in the downloadable copy of the presentation. The first one goes through the steps of configuring Link for hybrid. The second one goes through the steps of configuring Exchange UM for a hybrid where you've got Link on-prem. So depending on which side of the coin you're more interested in, those two links are useful. This link here is a great step-by-step walkthrough that talks about configuring on-prem Link with hybrid Exchange. And it's much more clickstream oriented than the other two. Microsoft's documentation says, do this, and if you want to know how to do it, go read this other TechNet link. Right? This walkthrough says, do this, which means open this console and click here and type this, and here's a picture. Step two, open this and click here, and here's another picture. Right? So if you want a really, really good visual guide that goes into great detail, that's probably going to be your best bet. Troubleshooting. Yes, you should. Okay, Microsoft has gotten really good at building troubleshooting commandlets into these products, in part because they want to be able to use them for automated product tests when they're developing, but also because you can take the output of these commandlets and feed them into management systems like Managed Availability or like SCOM. Right? So I think the future trend is pretty clear that we're going to continue to get more and better test commandlets as time goes on. So there's no reason you would know about or be using these commandlets if you weren't using these integration features before now, but I want you to know what they are so that you can use them after you get these features deployed. We've already talked about testing Exchange storage connectivity to verify that when you want to put an item into Exchange storage, you can. But notice what this does. It tests against the conversation history folder. Well, the good news is, as far as Exchange is concerned, if you can write an item into one folder, you can write it into any folder in that same mailbox because there generally are not mailbox-level access, or sorry, folder level access control entries in mailboxes. There can be, but nobody uses those, right? That was a notes feature that Exchange looked at and said, I don't think so. There's no good reason to have that. On the other hand, Test CS Unified Contact Store, right? So Test CS X Storage Connectivity uses OAuth to authenticate to the server and write an item into the target mailbox. Test CS Unified Contact Store does the same thing, but it does it through LIS. So testing Exchange Storage Connectivity is using pure EWS, but testing the UCS is actually using LIS, which will then use EWS. The reason for that distinction is that what this is testing is LIS configuration and LIS behavior. Now, there are no settings for LIS. There's nothing you can configure. There's nothing to tweak. So if this is broken, it's probably going to mean a call to support. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't test it. Now, these two commandlets are interesting because you use them actually to simulate the call path for a UM call. Testing the connectivity verifies that Link can simulate a call by sending SIP and RTP packets to the Exchange server and that the behavior that it sees is congruent with what it expects. If you look at the deck for Voice 401, it shows you the flow for the invite coming from Link to the Exchange client access server, getting a redirect, making a connection to the mailbox server, possibly getting a redirect or a 302, and then starting the audio stream. Okay, but all that testing UM connectivity does is test the SIP portion of that path. Test CSX UM voicemail tests the whole thing. It actually creates a voicemail in that user's mailbox. Notice that it doesn't actually do any audio quality testing or anything fancy like that. That's a whole separate Link infrastructure thing that I'm not equipped to talk about. But this will validate all aspects of the path, including actually delivering the voicemail to the user's mailbox, which generally is what you will want to do as a complete end-to-end test to verify that everything is working the way that it should. I promised to talk about troubleshooting contact photos. The good news is that there's very little to talk about here. Why? Because either you can see the contact photo when you type in this URL, or you can't. If you can't, 99.8 times out of 100, it's going to be because something is jacked up with your EWS configuration. Fix it. I mean, troubleshooting EWS is outside the scope of this presentation, but if you spend more than about 10 minutes working with either Link or Exchange, you're going to get pretty good at it because there's so many services that depend on it. Okay, where to learn more? There were three other sessions this afternoon, two of which were counter-programmed against this one that you could have gone to. I think they have repeats. I forgot to look when I was making this slide. This is a junk slide that should have been removed because it says the same thing, just with mystery dates. You should all buy my book. It's a great book, and it helps feed my kids. Very quickly, before I open questions, blah, 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 party tonight. Hands-on labs, they're fun. Please use my link to fill out your speaker evaluations for every single session you go to so that Jamie does not rage around yelling at actually, Jamie's not a yeller, but so he doesn't continue to badger the speaker saying, hey, would you guys make sure people fill out your evaluations? I think I have a couple more blah slides. Fill out evaluations to win fabulous prizes. Microsoft, yay. Now I'll take your questions. Or you can all get the hell out and go to the party. It's up to you. I've never been applauded for telling people to get the hell out before. I might have to do that more often.